Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The month of February has been an unusual one in central Pennsylvania when it comes to the region's weather. In the month when we typically receive the most snowfall of the winter, there has been very little snow this year. In fact, February 2020 may enter the record books for the least amount of snow in central Pennsylvania since records have been kept. That's at least at Harrisburg International Airport. Some will cheer the lack of snowfall and the hassles that come with it, while others will decry not having any snow this February. Those opinions are often based on our own lives and how we're affected. But what about the science of snow? Why is snow important? To answer those questions today is our guest, Dr. David Robinson, professor in the Department of Geography at Rutgers University and the New Jersey State climatologist. He tracks snow coverage worldwide with the Global Snow Lab. Dr. Robinson, welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Good morning.
If you have a question or a comment about snow, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Robinson, this is probably the question you've been asked most often this winter season, and I know it's the one that many central Pennsylvanians listening today have, and that is, why hasn't this region had much snow, really very little snow so far this winter?
Yeah, very little snow throughout the mid-Atlantic states, be it Jersey, Maryland, Pennsylvania. You know, some years it seems it just doesn't want to snow. And other years, you turn on the snow guns and it seems like it won't stop. And it has to do with the general circulation of the atmosphere, not just here in eastern North America, but really around the northern hemisphere. Everything's interconnected. And this year, the circulation pattern has been such that we've not had major storms in the area. And in particular, any time we've gotten precipitation, it has not been linked with a lot of cold air. So it's fallen as rain. So we haven't had abundant precipitation, and we certainly haven't had abundant cold weather. And together, they've conspired to give us essentially a snow drought, if you will.
Is this unusual?
Well, it's something that happens perhaps once every 10 years or so. These low levels of snow are certainly not unprecedented for central Pennsylvania and parts of the mid-Atlantic. Again, we sit at that magic borderline between temperatures being above and below freezing here in the mid-Atlantic. You know, you go further north, even in a mild winter, it's still cold enough to snow. And to our south, snow just tends to be rare most every year. So we're in that in-between zone where just a slight shift in weather patterns can make a big difference between being inundated with snow and being essentially snow-free.
I don't know whether our audience was focused on it or not, but the last story that NPR had right at the top of the hour was about a major snowstorm coming across the northern part of the country, the Great Lakes, and into New England, but still probably not, the temperature's still too high to produce a lot of snow here in central Pennsylvania or even where you are in New Jersey. So it is snowing somewhere. Many people judge weather and maybe even climate, but by what they see outside their own windows. So if it's not snowing here, is it snowing more than usual somewhere else?
Generally, that's the case. Interestingly enough, this winter, the lower 48 states have had low snow totals pretty much coast to coast. And January, for instance, everywhere in the lower 48 was warmer than average. Normally, if the west is cold and snowy, the east is mild and wet and vice versa. But this year, the jet stream has been riding so far to the north that it's not allowed cold air to infiltrate, at least for any extended period of time, over most of the U.S. But there are a few areas. For instance, northern Maine is running above average with snowfall this winter. Again, the temperatures are above average, but it's cold enough to snow. There's some parts of Siberia I've heard of reports of above average snow, but the lower 48 is low on the snow department. And in Europe, They're incredibly low for snow until you get to, say, northern Finland and, you know, northern Scandinavia in general. So a lot of the middle latitudes have had low snow totals this year, but that snow still has been found further north.
Let me ask you this. As a climatologist, is that alarming to you at all? Do you raise an eyebrow when you look at the low snow totals in some of the places? But, you know, above average, as I said, the northern Maine. Does it raise an eyebrow at all?
Not really in a single year. This is more weather than climate.
Aha. It's
somewhat indicative of what we might expect in the future, because we're working off a higher baseline with the warmer planet we're living on right now. So maybe the snowless becomes a little more snowless, and the cold becomes a little less cold. But generally, when we're talking about one year, one season, it's all about weather patterns. Again, not to dismiss the fact that climate change is underlying all of this, but natural variability tends to dominate in the short term.
You know, the reason I said that aha was that what you were describing earlier in the program, you sounded just like a meteorologist rather than a climatologist, because you were talking about patterns for this year in particular rather than the long term and years down the road, or what we've seen in recent years. But does the lack of snowfall this year, and we really have not had, I know we've had some big storms, but it seems, and from what I understand, one of the things that would be indicative of a changing climate would be big storms would continue from time to time, but there would be fewer smaller snowstorms.
Yeah, that's indicative of winter conditions, but just year-round in terms of precipitation. The expectation, and some evidence already suggests, that more of our precipitation is coming in larger events. It's not necessarily that we're getting more precipitation, although here in the mid-Atlantic we actually are, but elsewhere around the globe too, we're seeing more of the precipitation fall in large events, but not necessarily as many smaller events. So it's a feast or famine kind of situation.
We have an email here from a listener who says, my husband and I often joke that in Pennsylvania we will sometimes get a big snow in the fall, she says October, then nothing in the winter, then a big March blizzard. How common is this pattern?
Yeah, that can certainly happen, and that's often associated with the wavy pattern of the jet stream, where you'll have the jet stream dip below us for, say, a month, month and a half, and then the pattern will reverse for a month or month and a half. So you get these periodicities within the course of a winter. So you rarely have a winter that is snowy from stem to stern, but you don't often have a winter that's snow-free from stem to stern, as this year has been. In my memory bank, and I think many people in Pennsylvania will notice too, the winter of 1995-96, every month of the winter had above normal snowfall. Yet just 2 years later, the winter of 1997-98 was one of the least snowy winters of the last century, and they're only separated by 2 years. We went from a couple of inches of snow in a winter in the latter case and 6 feet of snow in the 95-96 winter. So there's a lot of this variability. And your listener is right. You often get things switched back and forth over the course of the winter season on multiple occasions.
I understand that one of your big surprises, though, and I read an interview with you where you said one of the surprises to you is the amount of snow that, and I always intended to say we, that I guess North America, the Northeast, has gotten in October and November, more so than what we usually have gotten, right?
This is more of a pattern that I've noticed hemispherically. Not necessarily as much in the Northeast, although we have had some memorable snow events in recent years, going back to a late October snow in 2011, and then there was a mid-November snow event that caught people off guard just a year ago. But generally across the Northern Hemisphere, we've seen an increased amount of snow cover, not necessarily deep snowfalls, but snow cover in October and November. And it appears to be more in the central, north-central portions of North America and in Eurasia, over Siberia. And it's a very interesting finding that we think may be associated, again, with changes in circulation that may be associated with reduced sea ice in the Arctic during the late summer and fall. Again, changes in the circulation pattern, but in areas in October and November that are still cold enough to snow.
So what you've just described, though, with the ice pack in the Arctic, that is related to climate change, correct?
Oh, no question. And in the spring season, what we've found, and I've been talking about for 30 years, is the earlier loss of snow cover in the spring. Snow is melting out earlier in the spring in all parts of the Northern Hemisphere. So we've got this diametrically opposed pattern that's appeared in the last decade or so that really is kind of the cutting edge of some research now as to why it's happening. But one thing's for sure, we are continuing to lose snow cover earlier in the spring. And with that, attendant concerns about water availability in the summer for irrigation and just general water resources, an increased threat of forest fire because your forests are drying out earlier in the spring. Just a lot of problems attendant with losing that snow cover earlier in the spring.
I just saw a satellite photo this week of a huge piece of ice or snow cover that broke off from Antarctica. What does that say to you?
Yeah, that was a big ice shelf, which is a section of the ice that had come off the continent. This is glacial ice from snowfalls in previous millennia. And we're seeing considerable what we call calving of that ice off of the Antarctic and even in Greenland in some respects. We don't have long records there, but it appears that the calving is being enhanced by warmer seas around the Antarctic. So, yeah, that's a major concern when it comes to the longer-term look at sea level and sea level rise.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News. And all things regional, I'm Scott Lamar. You can see some of the shows that we're working on coming up in the next week or so, including looking at what Pennsylvania is doing to try to stop the spread of the coronavirus. Also, Real ID, a lot of confusion about Real ID, and we'll be talking about that next Monday. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving a voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. Today we're talking about snow in February 2020 here in central Pennsylvania. Could be in the record books, from what I understand, unless we get some snow over the next few days, at least in the top three for seasons or February's with the least amount of snow. Our guest today is Dr. David Robinson. He's a professor in the Department of Geography at Rutgers University, the New Jersey State climatologist, and he tracks snow coverage with the Global Snow Lab. I think you could probably refer to Dr. Robinson as a snow guru. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are @smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Robinson, do you have a business card that says snow guru?
No, but I've been called worse, so that's pretty good.
I'm sure others have used that description as well. How does one become an expert on snow?
You know, many of us in the climate and weather world can trace our love of this subject back to our childhood. I remember some very deep snows growing up in northern New Jersey back in the 1960s, and perhaps that initiated me into this. I got to graduate school at Columbia University, and I linked up with someone who was studying early satellite mapping of snow extent back in the 1970s and early 80s, and it took off from there. So it's been a wonderful part of my career. And, it's awful nice when something you enjoy quite a bit you can make a career out of.
The Global Snow Lab at Rutgers, what do you do?
Yeah, our primary intent here is to monitor the distribution of snow cover over northern hemisphere continents. We look some to the southern hemisphere. We look over sea ice. We also dabble in snowfall and snowstorms, but primarily we're best known for our studies of the extent of snow over northern hemisphere lands. And it's so important for the reasons I mentioned earlier, water resources, for instance. But it's also important as an indicator or a means of monitoring and detecting climate variability and change. So it's quite an interesting variable. You know, the amount of snow cover over the northern hemisphere lands varies from about 50 million square kilometers at the height of winter to a few million square kilometers over the Greenland ice sheet in summer. So it's incredibly variable, and it has a very important part in the Earth's climate energy budget as well.
Okay, so let's talk about that a little bit. And we'll talk about the precipitation. We'll talk about the lack of snow as compared to rain. As you mentioned, and I think people here in central Pennsylvania, and again, have to add the caveat that we're just talking about a small little patch of the world when we're looking outside our windows. But still, that there has been much more precipitation here in central Pennsylvania and other places in North America over the last few years. What's the difference if it's rain or it's snow?
Well, there are different mechanisms that can produce, say, a rainy summer event. It could be a tropical system or abundant thunderstorms, as opposed to winter, where we get our precipitation with what we call middle latitude low pressure systems. It could be a nor'easter, for instance. Or today it's a storm that's going up through the Great Lakes, putting us on the warm southerly flow side of that event. So all of that will dictate what the temperature fields might be and whether we're going to get snow and or rain. So it's the same mechanisms in the winter. It's just where you're located with respect to the storm system and just how much cold air is available to that storm system. And that will determine whether you're going to be white or wet. You know, all of our winter precipitation starts as snow well up in the atmosphere where it's always cold enough to snow. It's just what happens to it on its way down to the surface.
Well, but I guess my question I should have asked was, long term, what's the difference between snow on the ground and precipitation in the form of rainfall?
Yeah, I've got you there. It's again, as I said earlier, it's that magic freezing point. It's just whether you're flirting below or above that freezing margin, it makes all the difference between whether you've got persistent snowfall and snow cover or you're just missing out on that snow. And again, here in the mid-Atlantic, we often sit right near that freezing point, whether it's a sunny day in the winter or whether it's a stormy day in the winter. For a meteorologist, it's a forecasting nightmare where that rain snow line is going to be. And with time and as climate changes, we expect all of this to shift to the north. But that doesn't mean we'll be shut out of snow completely. My goodness, last week in the midst of this snow-free winter in the east, there was 3 to 5 inches of snow in North Carolina and southern Virginia. So we will see snow well into the future. It's just the frequency of it should be on the downward side in the years ahead.
But there are repercussions to the lack of snow. For example, snow acts as a reservoir and you've touched on this, it can contribute to droughts in some areas, maybe even the water levels in lakes and streams, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, it's so important. Where we live, not as much because snow is ephemeral. It tends to come and go multiple times during the winter. And actually, the vast majority of our winter precipitation here falls as rain. We just notice the snow a lot more. But to remember, 10 inches of snow is roughly the equivalent of an inch of rain. And that's far more noticeable than just a plain old inch of rain. But when you get into the mountainous areas, even here in the Northeast, Up the Susquehanna Valley, for instance, you can accumulate quite a lot of water in that snowpack. And with that, supplying water in the spring, but also the danger that if it warms up too quickly and you get rain on top of that snow, you can have flooding concerns. The archetypical one event in the Susquehanna Valley was that rapid snowmelt after the blizzard of 1996. Early January, we had the snow. Mid-January, we had just an amazingly fast melt. And with that, tremendous, deadly flooding in the Susquehanna Valley. So that's it for the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast. But when you go out into the western U.S. and you go into the Himalayas, this is the source of water for billions of people. And the snowpack in the mountains serves as a reservoir for that snow, melting during the spring and summer season and keeping the rivers flowing. So it's just a tremendously important reservoir.
Let's go to Scott in Carlisle on the phone. Scott, you're on the air.
Yeah, I spend a fair amount of time up in Maine on Mount Desert Island, and I've always been amazed when they talk about the geology of the area and it having been carved from retreating glaciers. In the time that I've been up to see Maine in the past 50 years, I've never seen any glacial pack. But obviously there has been some global warming that occurred prior to this. I guess could you just speak on why we say that there's global warming that has been caused by man when there's obviously been over, you know, thousands of years a trend towards global warming?
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Scott. What about that?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking two very different timescales and very different mechanisms for the change. The ice ages, as we've come in and out of glacials and interglacials for the last couple of millions of years, are driven by orbital characteristics of the Earth around the Sun. And ice sheets on multiple occasions have made it down to northern Pennsylvania and northern New Jersey, just covering, smothering New England with ice. The last ice sheet retreated between, say, 20 to 10,000 years ago, and the globe's climate has been relatively stable in the last 10,000 years. Now we introduce the burning of fossil fuels by humans over the last century and a half or so. And what that has done is changed the energy balance within the Earth's atmosphere, retaining solar energy in the Earth's atmosphere and oceans longer than it had been in the past. It's as if we put another blanket on the bed. And with that, we've seen global temperatures rise over the last 150 years, most notably in the last 50 years or so. So we're talking different mechanisms. We're talking different timescales.
And this is just to follow up on Scott's question. You know, I remember the winter of 1977-78 in the Northeast when the region was hit by several big storms. I also remember Time magazine actually had a cover story called "The New Ice Age?" Now, climate change deniers often use that as evidence that climate is cyclical. Was there scientific evidence of changing climate at that time?
No, there wasn't. That was overly hyped by the media, and there's been numerous, several studies at least, that have tried to synthesize where the scientific literature was at that time. There's a couple reasons for that. One, we had gone several decades in the middle part of the 20th century without a lot of warming, but with carbon dioxide levels rising in the atmosphere, and we think that's associated with a dustier, dirtier atmosphere that kind of counteracted the fossil fuel-induced warming. There was also, at that time, we were beginning to understand why these mechanisms that brought us in and out of ice ages. And we learned that most interglacials were about 10,000 years long, and we were about 10,000 years into this interglacial. So over the next 100,000 years, one would expect it to get colder. But as I like to say, I didn't suggest you should go out and close your windows immediately. So there was even that confusion within the media and the, you know, the popular press. So there, we've known about the greenhouse effect since the 19th century, and early climate modeling on computers in the 1970s were all suggesting that with increasing greenhouse gases, the planet would warm. So this was no surprise to scientists as the warming induced by human activities began, that signal began to emerge from the noise of a very variable natural climate system. And that's over the last 50 years or so. Up until the 70s, we hadn't seen that human-induced signal begin to markedly emerge from the variability of the day-to-day, year-to-year, decade-to-decade weather and climate.
Should mention that Dr. Robinson is a graduate of Dickinson College, so you are familiar with central Pennsylvania overall, but you've been doing this for more than 30 years. And I'm curious, because this does go back to, the 70s as well. What changes have you seen in snow coverage, climate, in that time, the time you've been doing this?
Yeah. I should mention I had four fabulous years at Dickinson and Carlisle, and actually took 80 years of Carlisle climate data and wrote a small publication while for one of my courses while at Dickinson. It may still be buried in some libraries in central Pennsylvania.
Someone will have to look it up.
Yeah. I've still got it on my shelf here. I just love diving into the climate data, so that's a great question. We haven't seen major changes in the amount of snowfall here in the mid-Atlantic in past decades. We've had a lot of decadal variability, but no big trend in that. But over the, as I've mentioned earlier, over the northern hemisphere, we have seen a change, particularly over the last 30 years, in a declining spring snow cover. And then we've got this interesting pattern in October, November, in the higher latitudes of the northern hemisphere, just in the last decade or so. So we continue to see this variability, but we've seen this general trend, and I've published one paper with some colleagues where we've tried to do what's called an attribution study, where you're trying to determine what is causing that particular change. And when it comes to spring snow cover, our results pointed firmly to an anthropogenic or a human-induced influence on the decline of spring snow cover.
We have an email from a listener who says, I believe this is the fourth, at least the third winter since 2011-12, when there has been too little snow to have one good day of cross-country skiing in the Harrisburg area. In the 25 years prior, I only remember one such winter, 1997-98, and it should have been easier for me to find snow days these past 9 years because now I'm retired. That's coming from Rich. You're a cross-country skier too, aren't you?
Yeah, and my skis are still in the bag. I haven't gotten them out yet this year because we have never had 2 inches of snow on the ground here in central Jersey. My only hope is that the last three Marches in New Jersey were the snowiest months of the winter season. Although, to tell you the truth, it doesn't look too good right now looking at the 1 to 2 week outlooks. When it comes to the idea of snow staying on the ground, we've maybe seen a little bit of a decline in the number of days with snow cover. But when you're in central Pennsylvania, south central Pennsylvania, you're probably talking about 20 to 25 days of the winter season on average where more than an inch of snow is on the ground. More often than not, it's brown and not white. I know my 4 years in the 70s at Dickinson, there wasn't a lot of snow. We didn't get to take the trays from the cafeteria and slide down some of the hills on campus all that often.
I think about the repercussions of this. I'm wondering, will farmers be able to plant sooner this year or in years like this?
Yeah, and there's a little bit of a danger inherent in there. In that, the danger is more in terms of fruit trees and such. I get really nervous when things get warm in March. February, it's a little too early whether it's warm or not, but if it gets warm in March, you're still susceptible to a late season freeze. It's still winter up to our north, and maybe that jet stream pattern will change and drive some cold air in here, and it can ruin the crop for the season. Now, again, that's more for those in the apple and peach tree business. But in terms of farmers, they're going to look at soil temperatures. They're going to look at the time of the year. They're going to look at the moisture availability in the soils. And if the conditions are right and the soils warm up and the soils aren't too wet and we're past the point of a dangerous freeze, which would be well into April, if not early May, then they might get things into the ground earlier. They certainly can prepare earlier.
Let's take a call from Harry in Carlisle. Harry, you're on the air.
All right, thank you. Fellow Dickinson grad, degree in chemistry in 65 with a draft notice, and that was the end of chemistry. Anyway, I used to fly airplanes over Iceland to have support the dew line up there. And reading about Greenland, at one time, I guess when the Vikings were exploring, it was named Greenland for a reason. But when I flew up in there, it was ice from, I don't know, when we left Newfoundland or even further back, and it was solid all the way. And now it sounds like it's getting green again. Is it this? Was that one of those processes you talked about that was more natural? And now we're in the man-made thing for sure. And is there any equilibrium possible where as we get warmer, you don't need to use as much gas to heat the house or oil or the fossil fuels? I don't think we're ever going to stop the airplanes and things unless we come miraculously into we'll call it an invention, but you know, where you can transport yourself. So anyway,
All right, question on that. Harry, thank you very much for your call. And just to follow up on that last point, there was a story last week about one of the airlines trying to develop an electrical, a plane powered by electricity. But fellow Dickinson graduate that had a question for you about Greenland.
Yeah. Well, first, when it comes to the fossil fuel use and all, just remember, if we're doing less home heating, we're probably doing more summer air conditioning, and we're using electricity. But looking at Iceland, Greenland, there's some myth, some thought out there, I don't know if you call it a myth, that they called it Greenland just to fool people and Iceland to Iceland. Greenland has been covered with a major ice sheet throughout the last million years or more. That has maybe waxed and waned a little bit along the coast. It's gotten a little higher, a little bit lower. But it's always been there. However, there is change going on in Greenland. One of my colleagues is studying that with her grad students, and I sit on some of those graduate committees, and they're looking at the plumbing of the Greenland ice sheet and how more water is pouring off that ice sheet, how there's more melt events on top of that ice sheet in the last decade or two. So we are worried about the stability of that ice sheet, but it's not going anywhere anytime soon. It just may be changing its size a little bit, and with that, some concerns about sea level rise.
Let's go to Larry in Lancaster. Larry, you're on the air.
Hi. I have sort of a selfish question. I am headed for Antarctica next week to the peninsula, and I heard that temperatures are at an all-time high. It's upper 60s on the peninsula, and that some of the islands have lost their ice cover. I'm wondering if he knows anything about the conditions down there.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. We kind of addressed this, but go ahead.
Well, no, it's a great question. I wouldn't bring my swim trunks with me, but the Antarctic Peninsula did have some temperatures up into the 60s Fahrenheit recorded at a couple stations within the last month. A dome of high pressure sat to the north of there, and it helped to pump warm air from the middle latitudes down across the Southern Ocean towards the peninsula, a kind of an unusual atmospheric setup. But in general, that peninsula is one of the fastest warming spots on Earth, certainly the fastest warming spot in the Southern Hemisphere. And it goes along with the exceedingly rapid warming that we're seeing in the northern hemisphere polar regions as well. So, yep, they've had some unusual weather down there, but it is part of a pattern of increasing warmth there. And yes, and returning to what we discussed earlier, with that, some of the calving of the ice off of these ice shelves surround within the peninsula and nearby regions.
Dr. Robinson, final question. There have been some dire predictions about climate change and how long humans have to change behavior and possibly, you know, the Earth as it is now or as it used to be, how long it could last. And by that, I don't mean end completely, but still. So how do you see this?
Yeah, it's worrisome. There's absolutely no question about that. What we've already kind of sealed our fate for the next 30 years, no matter what we do in terms of our burning of fossil fuels and use of land, for instance. However, what we do now and in the next decade is going to dictate just how severe conditions get in the latter part of this century. This is models suggest that if we can control our fossil fuel use, we will be able to minimize the warming in the second half of this century and minimize the sea level rise. So the way I look at it, we had the ingenuity to get ourselves into this mess a bit by developing the use of fossil fuels and combustion engines and the Industrial Revolution. I'd like to think we're also smart enough that we can find ways of mitigating what we've done and also learn. We have to realize we're going to have to learn to adapt to some of these changes as well. So I don't want to leave people on a hopeless note, but people should be very concerned about where the direction of where things are heading now.
Dr. David Robinson, professor in the Department of Geography at Rutgers University, New Jersey, state climatologist. He tracks snow coverage with the Global Snow Lab. Thank you for very, very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Listen, tomorrow for Smart Talk, we'll actually be on a Smart Talk road trip to the Rose Lehrman Arts Center on the campus of Harrisburg Area Community College to discuss career and technical education. You can actually attend the broadcast in person if you would like. Go to WITF.org/events and RSVP. The NPR Student Podcast Challenge is back. Students in grades 5 through 12 can team up with their teachers to create a podcast for a chance to have a broadcast on NPR. Submissions are accepted until March 24th, so just a little less than a month, and the winning podcast will be featured in segments on either All Things Considered or Morning Edition. Joining us today are NPR's Education Desk podcast staff members, Lauren Magagi, she's a senior producer, and Jeffrey Pierre, an assistant producer. Welcome both of you to the program today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Well, I know a lot of people in our region have asked about the NPR Student Podcast Challenge. We've gotten questions from teachers, from school districts about it. Let's talk a little bit about the history, though, for those who may not be familiar. I know our regular listeners probably are, but tell me a little bit about how the NPR Student Podcast Challenge came to be and what you were looking to do.
Yeah, so, you know, before I even say anything, I have to give a shout to our boss Steve Drummond. This was sort of his vision. But he was like a former teacher. He had this idea of using project-based learning in the classroom, and he wanted to sort of give teachers a thing to do. He wanted to find a way to engage teachers, but this was like all his idea, and essentially. This is like a way that kids can learn about history. This is a way that kids can learn about like science in the classroom, and it makes it fun. it's, you know, it's a step further than like a research paper or like, you know, a diorama or something like that. So, you know, he had all this in mind, and he was like, why not host a competition? So this is the second year of the contest. The first year, you know, we opened it up to middle school and high school kids, as you said. Podcasts have to be between 3 to 10 minutes. You know, we have some prompts on our website about, like, what kids can make podcasts about, but, you know, it's also open to whatever they want. You know, last year we had, like, podcasts from, you know, things on race, but we also had podcasts on, like, tater tots, for example. It was, like, a couple of kids, like, you know, they interviewed a press person from, like, a French fry-making company. yeah, so, you know, the kids really have the freedom and flexibility to, you know, sort of, you know, speak their mind and sort of tell their stories. So this is year two. The competition has grown a little bit. Last year, for example, you know, for legal reasons, we didn't allow music. But this year, you know, we've opened it up to allow, you know, original music that students have to, like, write and perform themselves. So the contest is evolving, you know, but this is also, like, an opportunity for us, you know, to sort of get inside the classrooms. You know, we spend so much time on the education desk reporting on schools. You know, this is like an opportunity for us to see, like, you know, what does a lesson plan actually look like, and what are kids actually talking about right now?
Mm.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is, you know, one of the things that is so unique and why so many people listen to NPR on a daily basis is because of the storytelling.
Yeah.
And what you're looking for here with the NPR Podcast Challenge is you're looking for younger people to tell stories. And one of the most interesting parts of that is, you know, you mentioned about the tater tots, Jeffrey. And, you know, who would think of, I have to say, there probably are not a lot of adults who would think about doing a podcast about tater tots. But you get to, you know, you hear from these kids and their imaginations and the things that are important to them that they're talking about. And we adults don't often get to hear that.
Yeah, the interesting thing is, like, when you think about, like, podcasting as, like, you know, as, like, a medium, you know, there are a lot of podcasts, but there are maybe not that many podcasts for kids. And, you know, if I take that a step further, the podcasts that are out there for kids, they're usually about, like, kids things, you know, like teaching kids, like, lessons about, like, you know, life or something like that. It's, like, rare to find a podcast where kids are sort of talking about sports or talking about the news or talking about music. You know, usually, like, podcasts that are out there for kids are usually from that, you know, perspective. So, you know, that's something that, you know, we had in mind when we were putting all this stuff together, like, give these kids a voice and you know, let them tell vibrant stories, stories that are bigger than just their age or, like, you know, where they are in their lives.
Lauren Bagaghi, I'm going to play a clip here for you, and we can talk about this. This is from the Bronx Prep Middle School, and I have to admit that in talking to listeners and staff members last year when this was the winner in the middle school competition, that a lot of people were like, I can't really believe that that's what they're talking about. But here's a reaction from what we heard. Well, we are not going to be able to hear that. But actually what it was a podcast called Shush Periods that these middle school girls at Bronx Prep Middle School actually did a podcast about periods that they were experiencing, many of them for the first time. And again, a perfect example of something that you just don't hear a podcast about for any kind of broadcast.
Yeah, and I think what's really interesting, so they were our middle school list, our winners last year. We also had a high school group of winners. What was really interesting is we talked to them afterwards, and they sort of said, at first they wanted to talk about really broad national issues. They wanted to talk about immigration and LGBTQ issues. But then they just happened to be on their periods, and they ended up talking about this really personal issue that was really upsetting them. And the thing about that is when you talk from the heart and you speak about the things that are really affecting your life, I think it resonates with a lot of other people. And it was really, I think, after they won, they were blown away. One of the young women who was part of the podcast team said she had no idea that anyone would listen to them. And I think the beauty of this competition is it gives people and young students a voice and a platform that, you know, the typical essay for class maybe wouldn't necessarily, it wouldn't give you the same sort of spotlight.
Yeah, I wondered, and I have to admit, when I heard the broadcast, I thought to myself, what were the boys doing? Did they engage in this conversation at all?
You know, I think there was a really big mixed reaction. I think a lot of the boys were part of the reason that these girls felt so passionately. They felt they were getting teased in school. They felt like they didn't have the support of their peers. And so really what they recorded this podcast after school, and really what it was a safe space for them to come and kind of vent about these issues. I think that said, I think they've changed now their policy in their school about access to feminine hygiene products, and I think they've really actually changed the conversation. So at least now boys are actually even talking about periods, whereas I don't think that was happening before.
The high school level winner last year, Irwin, Tennessee. Now, there may be some members of our audience are familiar with what happened in Irwin, Tennessee that put it on the map, I hate to say it that way, but made it famous. They actually hung an elephant, and the podcast dug into why and how it happened. They won the high school contest. How did this all come about, hanging an elephant?
It's a very gruesome and horrific story. There was a parade one day, and there was an elephant who was marching in this parade, and the elephant trainer sort of lost control of the elephant and ended up trampling somebody. And you know, at the time, people were like, "This is a dangerous animal, and we have to put it down." And they were sort of like looking for ways to put the elephant down. And you know, in the podcast, they sort of go through all this stuff, but you know, they come to this idea that the easiest way is to like hang it from a crane, and you know, since then the town has sort of had this like reputation. Like even animal rights groups have like spoken out about like you know what they did, and you know it was really like a tarnish in like that city's reputation.
But I think the thing that was so great about it too is that they just followed their curiosity. They sort of took something that they'd known to be true their whole lives,
yeah,
and were just like, let's find out more.
So what about the teachers? What is the teachers' role in this? I mean, this is mostly about the kids, but what about the teachers?
So, the kids, like I said earlier, you know, they have the freedom to decide what they want to talk about. The teachers, and even like, you know, when we say teachers, we really mean like somebody who is in the role of like, as an educator. So that could be like even a counselor. You know, maybe if it's like somebody at your church group that you're working with, it's like an adult that's working with you in some kind of educational capacity. But they're there to like guide the students, help the students. They can't, you know, write scripts for the kids or give them the ideas, but they can help them edit, produce, you know, and sort of put together the ideas. But at the end, it's all on the students.
But I think also one of the funny things that's come about on this is that teachers have been put in the uncomfortable position of figuring out a lot of the podcast technology. So we're really trying to help them along with that this year. We started a podcast about how to make a podcast, so we're hopefully giving a little more help in the classroom now. But you are really seeing a wide range of teachers trying to tailor it to what they're teaching. One teacher submitted all of their podcasts were about Native Americans because that was clearly what they were learning about at the time. So it's really customizable.
We only have a minute or so left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. And as I said right up front, that we've been running promos here on the air at WITF and have gotten inquiries from teachers in the area, maybe even some students as well. So what advice would you give them as far as how to submit something to the podcast challenge?
Yeah, well, first I'd say I'm just going to plug our website to go to npr.org/student podcast challenge. It's got all of the rules and also a lot of how-tos. We've got lesson plans on there. There's a link to the podcast, which is really fun. We've got stuff about, like, how to have a good radio voice, you know, how to do some warm-ups and how to put music in your podcast.
Yeah.
But so that would be, like, the first step. But I think generally just really and anyone who tells stories knows this, is just to speak from the heart and to be authentic, and don't try to be the news person you hear on the air, but just try to be yourself.
And I think that probably is great advice for a lot of people, but Lauren Magagi and Jeffrey Pierre from NPR's Education Desk podcast staff, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
and looking forward to hearing some of those podcasts coming up on the air and getting the podcast themselves. Coming up tomorrow, a Smart Talk road trip to Harrisburg Area Community College, talking about career and technical education. Like to see you out there.